Citizenship demands a sense of common purpose, participation in the hard work of self-government, an obligation to serve our communities. And I know this chamber agrees that few Americans give more to their country than our diplomats and the men and women of the United States Armed Forces.
This is President Obama's State of the Union address. It is deeply into it by now, and everyone in the House chamber, I think, has risen, just about everyone, applauding the President's remarks about American servicemen and women and American diplomats, all of whom serve abroad. This is coverage of the address from NPR News.
Tonight, because of the extraordinary troops and civilians who risk and lay down their lives to keep us free, the United States is more secure. When I took office, nearly 180,000 Americans were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, all our troops are out of Iraq. More than 60,000 of our troops have already come home from Afghanistan. With Afghan forces now in the lead for their own security, our troops have moved to a support role. Together with our allies, we will complete our mission there by the end of this year, and America's longest war will finally be over. After 2014, we will support a unified Afghanistan as it takes responsibility for its own future. If the Afghan government signs a security agreement that we have negotiated, a small force of Americans could remain in Afghanistan with NATO allies to carry out two narrow missions: training and assisting Afghan forces, and counterterrorism operations to pursue any remnants of al-Qaeda. For while our relationship with Afghanistan will change, one thing will not: our resolve that terrorists do not launch attacks against our country. The fact is, that danger remains. While we've put al-Qaeda's core leadership on a path to defeat, the threat has evolved as al-Qaeda affiliates and other extremists take root in different parts of the world. In Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, Mali, we have to keep working with partners to disrupt and disable those networks. In Syria, we'll support the opposition that rejects the agenda of terrorist networks. Here at home, we'll keep strengthening our defenses and combat new threats like cyber attacks. And as we reform our defense budget, we will have to keep faith with our men and women in uniform and invest in the capabilities they need to succeed in future missions. We have to remain vigilant. But I strongly believe our leadership and our security cannot depend on our outstanding military alone. As Commander-in-Chief, I have used force when needed to protect the American people, and I will never hesitate to do so as long as I hold this office. But I will not send our troops into harm's way unless it is truly necessary, nor will I allow our sons and daughters to be mired in open-ended conflicts. We must fight the battles that need to be fought, not those that terrorists prefer from us, large-scale deployments that drain our strength and may ultimately feed extremism. So even as we actively and aggressively pursue terrorist networks, through more targeted efforts and by building the capacity of our foreign partners, America must move off a permanent war footing. That's why I've imposed prudent limits on the use of drones. For we will not be safer if people abroad believe we strike within their countries without regard for the consequence. That's why, working with this Congress, I will reform our surveillance programs, because the vital work of our intelligence community depends on public confidence, here and abroad, that privacy of ordinary people is not being violated. And with the Afghan war ending, this needs to be the year Congress lifts the remaining restrictions on detainee transfers and we close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Because we counter terrorism not just through intelligence and military actions, but by remaining true to our constitutional ideals and setting an example for the rest of the world. You see, in a world of complex threats, our security, our leadership, depends on all elements of our power, including strong and principled diplomacy. American diplomacy has rallied more than 50 countries to prevent nuclear materials from falling into the wrong hands and allowed us to reduce our own reliance on Cold War stockpiles. American diplomacy, backed by the threat of force, is why Syria's chemical weapons are being eliminated. And we will continue to work with the international community to usher in the future the Syrian people deserve, a future free of dictatorship, terror, and fear. As we speak, American diplomacy is supporting Israelis and Palestinians as they engage in the difficult but necessary talks to end the conflict there, to achieve dignity and an independent state for Palestinians, and lasting peace and security for the State of Israel, a Jewish state that knows America will always be at their side. And it is American diplomacy, backed by pressure, that has halted the progress of Iran's nuclear program and rolled back parts of that program for the very first time in a decade. As we gather here tonight, Iran has begun to eliminate its stockpile of higher levels of enriched uranium. It's not installing advanced centrifuges. Unprecedented inspections help the world verify every day that Iran is not building a bomb. And with our allies and partners, we're engaged in negotiations to see if we can peacefully achieve a goal we all share, preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. These negotiations will be difficult. They may not succeed. We are clear-eyed about Iran's support for terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, which threatens our allies. And we're clear about the mistrust between our nations, mistrust that cannot be wished away. But these negotiations don't rely on trust. Any long-term deal we agree to must be based on verifiable action that convinces us and the international community that Iran is not building a nuclear bomb. If John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan could negotiate with the Soviet Union, then surely a strong and confident America can negotiate with less powerful adversaries today. The sanctions that we put in place help make this opportunity possible. But let me be clear. If this Congress sends me a new sanctions bill now that threatens to derail these talks, I will veto it. For the sake of our national security, we must give diplomacy a chance to succeed. If Iran's leaders do not seize this opportunity, then I will be the first to call for more sanctions and stand ready to exercise all options to make sure Iran does not build a nuclear weapon. But if Iran's leaders do seize the chance, and we'll know soon enough, then Iran could take an important step to rejoin the community of nations, and we will have resolved one of the leading security challenges of our time without the risks of war. And finally, let's remember that our leadership is defined not just by our defense against threats, but by the enormous opportunities to do good and promote understanding around the globe, to forge greater cooperation, to expand new markets, to free people from fear and want. And no one is better positioned to take advantage of those opportunities than America. Our alliance with Europe remains the strongest the world has ever known. From Tunisia to Burma, we're supporting those who are willing to do the hard work of building democracy. In Ukraine, we stand for the principle that all people have the right to express themselves freely and peacefully, and to have a say in their country's future. Across Africa, we're bringing together businesses and governments to double access to electricity and help end extreme poverty. In the Americas, we're building new ties of commerce, but we're also expanding cultural and educational exchanges among young people. And we will continue to focus on the Asia Pacific, where we support our allies, shape a future of greater security and prosperity, and extend a hand to those devastated by disaster, as we did in the Philippines when our Marines and civilians rushed to aid those battered by a typhoon, and who are greeted with words like, "We will never forget your kindness," and "God bless America." We do these things because they help promote our long-term security. And we do them because we believe in the inherent dignity and equality of every human being, regardless of race or religion, creed or sexual orientation. And next week, the world will see one expression of that commitment when Team USA marches the red, white, and blue into the Olympic Stadium and brings home the gold. My fellow Americans, no other country in the world does what we do. On every issue, the world turns to us, not simply because of the size of our economy or our military might, but because of the ideals we stand for and the burdens we bear to advance them. No one knows this better than those who serve in uniform. As this time of war draws to a close, a new generation of heroes returns to civilian life. We'll keep slashing that backlog so our veterans receive the benefits they've earned and our wounded warriors receive the health care, including the mental health care that they need. We'll keep working to help all our veterans translate their skills and leadership into jobs here at home. And we will all continue to join forces to honor and support our remarkable military families. Let me tell you about one of those families I've come to know. I first met Corey Remsburg, a proud Army Ranger, at Omaha Beach on the 65th anniversary of D-Day. Along with some of his fellow Rangers, he walked me through the program and the ceremony. He was a strong, impressive young man. He had an easy manner. He was sharp as a tack. And we joked around and took pictures, and I told him to stay in touch. A few months later, on his 10th deployment, Corey was nearly killed by a massive roadside bomb in Afghanistan. His comrades found him in a canal, face down, underwater, shrapnel in his brain. For months, he lay in a coma. The next time I met him in the hospital, he couldn't speak, could barely move. Over the years, he's endured dozens of surgeries and procedures, hours of grueling rehab every day. Even now, Corey's still blind in one eye, still struggles on his left side. But slowly, steadily, with the support of caregivers like his dad, Craig, and the community around him, Corey has grown stronger. Day by day, he's learned to speak again, and stand again, and walk again. And he's working toward the day when he can serve his country again. My recovery has not been easy, he says. Nothing in life that's worth anything is easy. Corey is here tonight. And like the Army he loves, like the America he serves, Sergeant First Class Corey Remsburg never gives up and he does not quit. Corey.
Sergeant Remsburg now stands in the gallery, standing beside First Lady Michelle Obama, his father to his right, and everyone in the hall applauding this veteran of the war in Afghanistan who was so terribly injured by a roadside bomb. By far the most prolonged applause of this State of the Union address. And Sergeant Remsburg waving to acknowledge the applause of the members of the House and Senate and other dignitaries who are gathered to hear the President's State of the Union address.
My fellow Americans, men and women like Corey remind us that America has never come easy. Our freedom, our democracy has never been easy. Sometimes we stumble. We make mistakes. We get frustrated or discouraged. But for more than 200 years, we have put those things aside and placed our collective shoulder to the wheel of progress to create and build and expand the possibilities of individual achievement, to free other nations from tyranny and fear, to promote justice and fairness and equality under the law so that the words set to paper by our founders are made real for every citizen. The America we want for our kids, a rising America where honest work is plentiful and communities are strong, where prosperity is widely shared, and opportunity for all lets us go as far as our dreams and toil will take us. None of it is easy. But if we work together, if we summon what is best in us, the way Corey summoned what is best in him, with our feet planted firmly in today but our eyes cast toward tomorrow, I know it is within our reach. Believe it. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
President Barack Obama, delivering his fifth State of the Union address. I'm Robert Siegel. You heard the president concluding on a very moving note as he acknowledged one of his guests, Sergeant First Class Corey Remsburg, proud Army Ranger, he said, whom the president had met before Sergeant Remsburg was injured in Afghanistan. And it was quite a moment during which this veteran who's managed to come back through many surgeries and much therapy managed to wave and give a thumbs up to all the people who were applauding him. Now we're going to wrap up. We're going to sum up some of the high points of the speech and then hear some commentary from our commentators, and pretty soon we'll hear the Republican response. First, NPR's Mara Liasson is here, our national political correspondent. Mara, what stands out to you? What are the high points of the State of the Union?
Well, I think that the talk about that this can be a breakthrough year, that this is going to be a year of action. I think the president really played off against the, caricature of him in the media now, which is that he's almost a lame duck. He's suffering from low ratings. He can't get anything done in Congress. I think the speech was meant to be a counterpoint to that, and I think he succeeded. I thought it was a pretty modest speech. It wasn't very adversarial, no soaring rhetoric. But he explained what he was going to do, which is he's going to use his own powers as much as possible by himself to advance the economic security of the middle class and those who want to get into it. And as he said, he's going to offer tonight a set of concrete, practical proposals. And he did. Some of them are very small. This is the kind of small ball that he once criticized President Clinton for practicing. But when you can't get Congress to pass your big initiatives, this is what you've got. And he's going to use, all the tools he has to push them forward.
Speech ran about an hour and 5 minutes. I don't believe that the president ever said the State of the Union is blank during the course of this.
No, and he actually had an interesting formulation for that. He said, tonight this chamber speaks with one voice to the people we represent. It is you, our citizens, who make the state of our union strong.
So therefore, the state
and
of the
that
union,
was hard. That would be hard to argue with.
President also, of course, in the end, wove together the story of the sacrifice of people in the service and people fighting wars with the hard tasks at home. He is striving for an America where, he said, honest work is plentiful and where prosperity is widely shared. The theme of economic inequality was mentioned here. But am I right, Mara, that all the talk of redressing that problem was in bringing people at the bottom up, expanding opportunity for them? There was none of the talk of redistributing the wealth that people at the top now enjoy.
No, that seems to be behind this White House. He said he wants
behind
to,
as their past.
As in past. Yes, they've done that. They're not going to try again. They're not going to try to raise taxes on the rich. He talked about building new ladders of opportunity into the middle class. Talked about universal pre-K. Wants to raise the minimum wage, which is not a government program. New savings accounts. A tax reform, incentives to keep jobs here.
Big infrastructure program.
Which he has tried in the past, and there is some bipartisan interest in that in Congress. But this was not a redistributionist approach to income inequality.
Okay. Thank you, Mara. That's NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. And also in the studio are Ramesh Ponnaru, who is senior editor at the National Review, and Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. And Ramesh, first from you, your thoughts on President Barack Obama's fifth official State of the Union. There's another one that doesn't quite count as an official State of the Union. What did you think?
I kept thinking back to the president's comment during the 2008 race that he wanted to be a transformative president, which was, of course, an implicit shot at President Bill Clinton for not having been a transformative president. And here he is now playing small ball, giving a State of the Union address that reminds me of nothing so much as one of Clinton's State of the Union addresses, replete with all of these small initiatives.
E.J. Dionne, would you agree with that? Small ball?
I don't think it's necessarily small ball, but I'm going to make it unanimous. I really thought of Clinton here because he ticked off one proposal after another, not enormous. The MyRA accounts for to help people save, Select USA to get foreign companies to locate here, connect 20 million students in 15,000 schools to the best technology, redesign high school. There were a whole list of proposals that were not, did not require legislation, but he did call for the minimum wage increase and is using an executive order to do it for federal employees. He called for extending unemployment, expanding the earned income tax credit. That is an important thing that he's doing for single workers. And then he went back to pre-K and infrastructure. I just have to add that the story of Sergeant Corey Remsburg just made all the thanks we give to veterans all the time seem terribly inadequate. That was just a deeply moving story.
Yeah. It's also a reminder that, in fact, presidents do meet servicemen and women, not just in theaters of combat, but when they're in this case, they were at Omaha Beach in Normandy, and later he visited him in the hospital.
And it reminds us we're still at war, wars that we don't pay much attention to.
Ramesh, what did you think about that? At the very beginning of the State of the Union, the president drew a picture almost of a country awakening from a terrible a long night of war and recession, and now we're snapping out of it. Do you think it resonates with what people feel about the country right now?
Well, I think if you look at the surveys, they suggest that people still think the recession is ongoing, and they don't yet feel that kind of the kind of surging optimism that the president, I think, is trying to move them towards. And I think that he sort of acknowledges this public mood several times when he talks about how things aren't easy. But the fact is the public doesn't see the statistics in quite the light that he wants them to.
As we speak, by the way, President Obama is making his way down the aisle to the exit from the House chamber. And after he gets out, then the countdown begins for the Republican response to the State of the Union. It'll be given by Representative Kathy McMorris Rodgers of Washington State. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. One more issue I wanted to put to both of you, E.J. Dionne and Ramesh Ponnoru, which is immigration. The president urged Congress to hear the support of clergy and others all around the country to reform immigration laws. What's your sense? Do you think it's actually going to happen? Is there enough common interest there to actually get either a big immigration reform or some smaller immigration reforms?
I think that the Republican Party seems to be moving in that direction. John Boehner certainly seems to be moving in that direction. And this speech was a very pro-John Boehner speech. He had that lovely reference early on that the son of a barkeeper is Speaker of the House. And then when he talked about immigration, he was very careful not to be partisan. He took a real poke at Republicans for having 40 votes against Obamacare. The first 40 were plenty. He said on immigration, he was utterly nonpartisan. Partisan, because I think he sees a real possibility.
Ramesh, what do you think? What do Republicans think about immigration reform at this stage?
Well, the House Republicans are about to hold their retreat in Cambridge, Maryland over the next 3 days, and I think that's going to be the number one topic of conversation. I think they're still not sure what they want to do, and they're deeply divided. If something passes, it will not be, I think, with a majority of House Republicans supporting it.
And at last word, Speaker John Boehner didn't like bills that would be passed without a majority of his conference. He wouldn't put such things to the floor. Would he think differently about immigration, you think?
Well, I think that he's done it on occasion, even though he said he wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But this one would really, I think, put his followership to the test. And people who are willing to put up with those other departures from that rule, I think, would have a problem with this.
You're
one.
Speaking of his followership, of how well he's following the sentiment of the House Republican
How
Conference.
Well is he following his followers?
See, I have a theory. I'm curious if Ramesh shares this, that there could be a majority of Republicans who actually want it to pass, but not all people in that majority will vote for it. And that could get us immigration reform.
That happens sometimes.
All right. Let's turn now to a member of the House Republican Conference, indeed a deputy whip for the Republican Conference, Representative Tom Cole, Republican of Oklahoma, who's joining us now from the Capitol. Congressman Cole, we were just talking about immigration. Did you hear from the president something about immigration that could be the basis for an actual reform?
Well, look, the president's been consistent on the issue. I give him credit for that. I think earlier, not so much in this speech, he mentioned he might accept a step-by-step approach. And I think that's really the only way it's going to get done. I mean, the Senate comprehensive approach is simply not going to pass the House. So we've got four bills out of the House Judiciary Committee. There's some others coming. So there might be a way to make some modest progress, but I think it will be modest, not comprehensive.
He appealed for an end to votes to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that's behind us right now, that indeed Republicans might be better with the Affordable Care Act in place to run against in November?
Well, I think Republicans are never going to stop trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Look, that's something that's not popular. No Republican voted for it. Frankly, all the polling suggests it's become progressively less popular over the last several months. So I doubt that's going to disappear. But I also think you have to recognize political reality. There's a Democratic Senate. The president's not likely to accept the repeal of his signature issue. I always like to say, you know, not likely to repeal Obamacare when a guy named Obama is president of the United States. So, you know, I recognize that. But, you know, as the president failed to point out, we've actually given him seven bills dealing with that legislation that he has signed that passed the Democratic Senate. Everything from getting rid of 1099 tax forms that every merchant was going to be required to use to, frankly, repealing the assisted living program of his portion, which was financially unsound. So there's some areas around the edge, maybe the medical device tax that we can work on together. I don't think Democrats like that any more than Republicans. But again, Republicans are not likely to accept it. But you do have to recognize political reality. While we may vote to repeal, that's not going to get through the Senate. So let's change where we can. And if we can find some common ground, terrific.
Okay. Congressman Cole, it's been real, as always.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you,
Robert.
It's Tom Cole, a Republican of Oklahoma, talking with us about his reading of his listening of the State of the Union. Joining me is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Ron, we're counting down to the Republican response. Tell us about the member we're about to hear.
Kathy McMorris Rodgers is the fourth-ranking Republican in the House. She is the highest-ranking woman in the Republican hierarchy in the United States Congress. And she is going to deliver what is an upbeat and inspirational message, largely about her own life and her personal achievements and where she's come from and what the Republican Party would offer the country as reflected in her own career and life.
Representative Rodgers, who's given birth to three children while in the House. She's from Eastern Washington State, and we should be hearing her from the Capitol right now.
What an honor it is for me to be with you after the President's State of the Union. Tonight, we honor America, a nation that has witnessed the greatest rise of freedom and opportunity our world has ever seen. A nation where we are not defined by our limits, but by our potential, and a nation where a girl who worked at the McDonald's drive-thru to help pay for college can be with you from the United States Capitol. But the most important moments right now aren't happening here. They're not in the Oval Office or in the House chamber. They're in your homes, kissing your kids goodnight, figuring out how to pay the bills, getting ready for tomorrow's doctor's visit, waiting to hear from those you love serving in Afghanistan, or searching for that big job interview. After all, we the people have been the foundation of America since her earliest days. People from all walks of life and from all corners of the world. People who come to America because here, no challenge is too great and no dream too big. That's the genius of America. Tonight, the president made more promises that sound good, but won't actually solve the problems facing Americans. We want you to have a better life. The president wants that too. But we part ways when it comes to how to make that happen. So tonight, I'd like to share a more hopeful Republican vision, one that empowers you, not the government. It's one that champions free markets and trusts people to make their own decisions, not a government that decides for you. It helps working families rise above the limits of poverty and protects our most vulnerable. And it's one where Washington plays by the same rules that you do. It's a vision that is fair and offers the promise of a better future for every American. If you would have told me as a little girl that I would one day put my hand on the Bible and be sworn in as a 200th woman to serve in the House of Representatives, I wouldn't have thought it possible. I grew up working on my family's orchard and fruit stand in Kettle Falls, a small town in eastern Washington, getting up before dawn with my brother to pick apples. My dad drove a school bus, and my mom worked as a part-time bookkeeper. They taught me to work hard, help others, and always, always dream for more. So when I showed my 4-H animals at the county fair, my parents used to say to me, "Kathy, you need to save this money so you can go to college one day." And so I did. I saved, I worked hard, and I became the first in my family to graduate from college. The chance to go from my Washington to this one was unexpected. I came to Congress to help empower people, not politicians, to grow the working middle class, not the government, and to ensure that everyone in this country can find a job. Because a job is so much more than a paycheck. It gives us purpose, dignity, and the foundation to build a future. I was single when I was elected, but it wasn't long before I met Brian, a retired Navy commander, and now we have three beautiful children, one who was born just 8 weeks ago. Like all parents, we have high hopes and dreams for our children, but we also know what it's like to face challenges. 3 days after our son was born, Cole, we got news no parent expects. Cole was diagnosed with Down syndrome. The doctors told us he could have endless complications, heart defects, even early Alzheimer's. They told us all the problems. But when we looked at our son, we saw only possibilities. We saw a gift from God. And today, we see a 6-year-old boy who dances to Bruce Springsteen, who reads above grade level, and who is the best big brother in the world. We see all the things he can do, not those he can't. And Cole and his sisters, Grace and Bren, have only made me more determined to see the potential in every human life, that whether we're born with an extra 21st chromosome or without a dollar to our name, we are not defined by our limits, but by our potential. Because our mission, not only as Republicans, but as Americans, is to once again ensure that we are not bound by where we come from, but empowered by what we can become. That is the gap Republicans are working to close. It's the gap we all face between where you are and where you want to be. The president talks a lot about income inequality, but the real gap we face today is one of opportunity inequality. And with this administration's policies, that gap has become far too wide. We see this gap growing every single day. We see it in our neighbors who are struggling to find jobs, a husband who's now working just part-time, a child who drops out of college because she can't afford tuition, or parents who are outliving their life savings. Last month, more Americans stopped looking for a job than found one. Too many people are falling further and further behind because right now, the president's policies are making people's lives harder. Republicans have plans to close the gap, plans that will focus on jobs first without more spending, government bailouts, and red tape. Every day, we're working to expand our economy, one manufacturing job, nursing degree, and small business at a time. We have plans to improve our education and training systems so you have the choice to determine where your kids go to school, so college is affordable and skills training is modernized. And yes, it's time to honor our history of legal immigration. We're working on a step-by-step solution to immigration reform by first securing our borders and making sure America will always attract the best, brightest, and hardest working from around the world. And with too many Americans living paycheck to paycheck, we have solutions to help you take home more of your pay through lower taxes, cheaper energy costs, and affordable health care. Not long ago, I got a letter from Betty in Spokane, who had hoped the president's health care law would save her money, but found out instead her premiums were going up nearly $700 a month. We've all talked to too many people who've received cancellation notices they didn't expect, or who can no longer see the doctors they always have. No, we shouldn't go back to the way things were, but this law is not working. Republicans believe healthcare choices should be yours, not the government's, and that whether you're a boy with Down syndrome or a woman with breast cancer, you can find coverage and a doctor who will treat you. So we hope the president will join us in a year of real action by empowering people, not by making their lives harder with unprecedented spending, higher taxes, and fewer jobs. As Republicans, we advance these plans every day because we believe in a government that trusts people and doesn't limit where you finish because of where you started. That is what we stand for. It's for an America that is every bit as compassionate as it is exceptional. If we're successful, years from now, our children will say that we rebuilt the American dream. We built a working middle class that could take in anyone and a workforce that could take on the world. Whether you're a girl in Kettle Falls or a boy from Brooklyn, our children should be able to say that we closed the gap. Our plan is one that dreams big for everyone and turns its back on no one. The president said many things tonight, but now I ask him to listen to you. For the true state of the union lies in your heart and in your home. Tomorrow, I'll watch my son Cole get on the school bus. Others will wait in the doctor's office or interview for that first job. Some of us will celebrate new beginnings. Others will face great challenges. But all of us will wake up and do what is uniquely American. We will look forward to the boundless potential that lies ahead. We will give thanks to the brave men and women who have answered America's call to freedom, like Sergeant Jacob Hess from Spokane, who recently gave his life to protect all of ours. So tonight, I simply offer a prayer. A prayer for Sergeant Hess's family, your family, and for our larger American family, that with the guidance of God, we may prove ourselves worthy of his blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For when we embrace these gifts, we are each doing our part to form a more perfect union. May God guide you and our president, and may God continue to bless the United States of America.
Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State. That was this year's Republican response to the State of the Union address. Ron Elving, thoughts on that response?
We heard a simple and heartfelt direct appeal from a woman to Americans, and I think she emphasized a great deal her own personal story. And if we were talking earlier about echoes of the Clinton era in the president's speech, I think I heard many echoes here of the Reagan era. She talked in inspirational terms about family, about faith, about work, about American exceptionalism, mentioned God a number of times, and in the end talked a lot about opportunity and getting rid of government bureaucracy and red tape, all the themes that I think we all remember from the Ronald Reagan years.
And Representative Rogers said the true state of the union lies in your heart and in your home. And at the beginning of his State of the Union message today, the president said, "It is you, our citizens, who make the state of our union strong." A very similar thought. I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to live special coverage from NPR News.
Support for NPR's coverage of the State of the Union comes from Netflix, with Season 2 of House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, and Kate Mara. All episodes premiere on Friday, February 14th, on Netflix.
This is special coverage from NPR News of the president's State of the Union address. The president concluded about 20 minutes ago or so, and we've since heard the Republican response. And we're now going to hear from a member of the Democratic Senate leadership, Senator Patty Murray of Washington State. She's a member of the Senate Democratic. She's secretary of the conference in the Senate and also chair of the Senate Budget Committee. Welcome, Senator Murray.
Well, nice to talk to you this evening.
Well, the president gave what some people in our studio heard as a Bill Clinton-like small ball speech. Is that how you heard it?
What I heard him do tonight is talk directly to millions of Americans who are saying, how can I get ahead? What is my country going to do to support me coming out of these difficult times? And he very clearly, specifically talked about, yes, they were might be considered small, but concrete steps that will give people back some of the security they so desperately want today.
You managed, you were central to negotiating a budget deal, a bipartisan budget deal. Was that a one-off experience, or do you think that it's the Democrats and Republicans in Congress are capable, say, of approaching immigration or universal pre-K and actually reaching agreement on such issues?
I sincerely hope for it. Look, what I heard from so many people after I was able to negotiate an agreement, budget agreement with Congressman Paul Ryan, is that they were so relieved to see that our country, our democracy, could work, that we could do what we needed to do to manage our country and to get us out of this crisis management where we were hearing about government shutdowns and not paying our bills and economic crises. They want our country to work, and they were grateful that two of us went out of our way to find a bipartisan agreement to get us back on that track. I'm hopeful that can show us all how we can address these issues of immigration reform and pre-K education and making sure that people have job training. I think that's what our country wants us to do.
It seems, though, that the Democrats on the Hill are in this situation now where it's, as difficult as it may be, it's easier for you to negotiate, for Democrats in the Senate to negotiate with Republicans in the House, and then have the president come and approve that and accept and sign that agreement, rather than have the president engage directly. He doesn't seem to be a positive contributor to negotiating things.
I would challenge that a bit, because clearly the president has put forth a push to Congress for a long time to put together a budget agreement that got us out of the crisis that we were in. And his direction to us all the way along has been to do that. He offered numerous suggestions. I stayed in close touch with him as we were putting this budget agreement together. But the president has the obligation to tell the country what steps he believes in will help us get to a stronger economy and more economic security for American families and businesses. That is what he outlined tonight, and I think that outline that he gave us is one that we should now sit and work together in a bipartisan way to try and reach.
Senator Murray, thank you very much for talking with us about
Absolutely.
It. Patty Murray, Democratic Senator of Washington State, Secretary of the Democratic Conference in the Senate, and also Chair of the Senate Budget Committee, and as she said, the Democratic architect of a budget agreement with Paul Ryan, the Budget Committee Chair from the Republican-controlled House. Speaking of the House, we're going to hear from a House Republican right now, Representative Tim Huelskamp of Iowa, who's a Tea Party Republican. And we should say, Congressman Huelskamp, there actually is, I think as we speak right now, there is another response to the State of the Union being given by, is it Senator Mike Lee, who's speaking for the Tea Party?
There are a number of responses. We had a response.
Excuse me, from Kansas. I misidentified what state. My apologies.
I'm from the state of Kansas. Yes, there was a response coming currently from Senator Mike Lee and other conservatives. Kathy Morris Rogers gave an excellent response as well about the Republican response to the State of the Union address. But what we didn't hear was some of the bad news. After 6 years of our 5 years of this president, we have millions more in poverty, millions more on food stamps, trillions of dollars in new debt. I was hoping for a new direction, but we got more of the same, programs and more spending, and the end result has not been working out very well.
Of course, he would say that Republican austerity and ending certain benefits and not passing more stimulus, that's contributed to the problem, would be the Democratic response to what you've just said.
Well, actually, the president had 2 straight years to do anything he wanted to do. He passed the stimulus. They did not do immigration. He passed Obamacare, and the end result is we have today, and I think all politicians agree, it's not a good situation when you have 24 million Americans out of work. But what I heard tonight is the same thing we heard last year and the same thing as the year before, that let's spend a bunch more money, start a bunch more programs. But at the end of the day, what we need to do is encourage entrepreneurs, and Obamacare actually does the opposite.
Just one other question, Congressman Huelskamp. Yes. I mean, there is something about a party having multiple responses to the State of the Union that doesn't seem altogether healthy. That is, the idea that Congresswoman Rogers gave one speech and then Senator Lee gives one and Senator Rand Paul will give one suggests Republicans are quite fractured at this point. Would you agree with that?
Well, there are differences of opinions, and certainly there's differences of opinions where we might head in general, but the specifics, as Republicans understand, the problem isn't that we have not enough government, it's that we have too much, and all Republicans agree on that. But that's where we disagree with the president. He proposed numerous new programs, numerous executive orders, things to try to force job creation. It hasn't worked out. And what I have asked is the president to admit his policies have failed. But he did not do that tonight. No. He has to own the fact that he has been president for 1,834 days, and the economy is still flatlined. And that's not good for American families.
Well, Congressman Heuskamp, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Tim Heuskamp of Kansas. It would be an unusual State of the Union in which a president said, I have failed as president, but obviously in the eyes of the Tea Party, he certainly has. One more member of Congress we're going to hear from right now, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is standing by. Senator Manchin, did you hear a speech that was encouraging and might signal a reset on Capitol Hill in the president's dealings with Congress?
I thought there was an awful lot of things to walk away with that gave us some hope that we can come together as Americans and put the country first before our political aspirations, if you will. We've had enough of that for so long. And, you know, I like specifically, you know, if you're going to create a job, give an incentive, make sure we have a job at the end of the day. And that rings very well in West Virginia. We want jobs. We need jobs. And if we can get companies to give incentives and this government can stimulate that with incentives, that's going to help tremendously. And I like that part of it. I'm interested in this new
IRA.
Yeah. I've not heard about that. I would say it's probably going to be a 401k on steroids, hopefully, or something of that sort, with portability. And that's a good thing. So we'll look and learn more about that, too. But there was a few good things there that we really liked.
So, coming from a state where President Obama is not very popular, did he give you some things that you could take home and say
this administration
is doing well by West Virginians?
Well, our hard thing is we've had a hard time with the environmental end of it, just trying to work with a balance between the environment and the economy. And we produce an awful lot of coal, as you know, and we produce an awful lot of natural gas, and we've been heavy lifters as far as doing good jobs, hard jobs, working hard for this country. With that being said, we don't get a lot of love on that end of it or recognition. And this whole thing about $4 billion on fossil, I don't know where that came from. I don't know. I'm not seeing that those tax credits he's talking about. Someone look into that. But those are concerning things, and he has a hard time in my state.
Yep. Okay. Well, Senator Manchin, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Joe Manchin of West Virginia. This speech, a lot of it was about things that can be done to improve job creation in the country and help people enter the middle class, and that included education. And our education correspondent, Claudio Sanchez, was listening. What did you hear?
It seems that a lot of his proposals were carefully crafted to fit this overall theme of opportunity for all. Preschool, for example, $75 billion in the next 10 years was what the president proposed to expand preschool programs. But that was in his 2013 address, and it didn't go very far. This, of course, would be really a way to at least triple the number of four-year-olds in state-run programs by the year 2020. Again, there is legislation on the Hill, but it's not going very far. What's happening, though, is that states, at least 30 of them, have really increased funding for preschool in the last year or so by 7%, in 10 states by 20%. So there is a lot of buy-in to what the president is saying. Whether the federal government is really going to come up with the money is very unclear.
That would be a dramatic change from the past year, you're saying, if they did, since we heard that.
And Robert, on the question of K-12 education, the president said that his Race to the Top initiative has been a success, and yet we're seeing, by all accounts, really, really bad or not very good figures on where American teenagers, American students are compared to the rest of the world in math and reading. But what most educators resent about the president's education policies has been that it's been a carrot and stick approach, distributing billions of dollars to the states on the condition that they adopt reforms prescribed by the administration, creating career college ready standards, shutting down failing schools, using test scores to evaluate teachers. All of these very controversial, all generating lots of pushback from the teachers' unions, parents' groups that hate the idea of more testing, and minority community activists who say that neighborhood schools are being shut down and replaced by privately run charter schools, or what they call the privatization of public education.
Just note, the president did make one passing dismissive remark about teaching kids how to think, not just how to fill in bubbles on a test. It wasn't a substantive critique of educational programs, but the tone, the mood certainly was one that wanted something other than a lot of testing. Claudio, thank you.
Thank you.
We've heard the president's State of the Union and the response to it. With me in the studio are NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving and our guest commentators, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution and Ramesh Panaru of National Review. Ron, that's some summary thoughts here about the ideas we've heard this evening.
There did not seem to be a sharp engagement over the health care law, although, of course, Representative Rogers did go to criticisms of it and did talk about a person who had lost her health care or seen her premiums greatly increased. I think that person is probably going to be sought out and interviewed by a number of folks.
We'll hear about her story very soon.
Exactly what happened there. The president, on the other hand, was offering up examples of his own. Those will also be examined. But he did not spend very much time on the Affordable Care Act in his speech. He did not spend any appreciable amount of time on the entire controversy about the National Security Agency and all of the different kinds of surveillance we learned about last year. So he was eliding a number of subjects as well. Yeah. So both of these sides are trying to make a pitch in an election year. This is, after all, a significant midterm election year. We have to see that as a shadow over everything that happened tonight.
Here's something that the president said about what we expected would be and was, in fact, a major theme of the speech. He said this.
Today, after 4 years of economic growth, corporate profits and stock prices have rarely been higher, and those at the top have never done better. But average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled.
E.J. Dionne, Ramesh Panaru. First, E.J., social mobility or economic mobility has stalled is actually conflicted. That's in conflict with the recent Harvard study. But what did you think about this whole theme of inequality?
I think it is an issue very much on the mind of the country. And I've got to say, I was very struck by something in the McMorris Rogers speech in the Republican response, where she said the president talks a lot about income inequality, but the real gap we face today is opportunity inequality. Mostly, the president took the inequality issue and moved it immediately to the opportunity issue. This was a speech much more about a variety of programs to create opportunity than it was about inequality. I think this does show that he is back sort of moving toward offense. A few months ago, people would have said that the president's going to have to go up there and be very apologetic about Obamacare. He was utterly unapologetic. And in fact, he chided the Republicans for their many efforts to repeal it. And he is trying to move the nation's agenda to declining social mobility and inequality. And I think he took some steps in that direction. And Republicans are playing on that turf, too.
Ramesh, what did you think about that?
Well, I do think that there is a difference between casting the issue as one of inequality and one of opportunity. And the president, I think, very smartly shifted away from inequality, which he's been talking about as the defining challenge of our time. And today he talked about the defining project of our time being expanding opportunity. I think that's just something with deeper roots in American opinion, and it's a smart move on his part.
And he said in the speech, as he has said in the past, that we're Americans. We believe that if people have done something that warrants they're making a lot of money, they should make a lot of money. We don't envy them that. That was part of his presence. Ron?
That's right. And I think that some of the language that he was using tonight about opportunity and about wages and about the middle class sounded a lot more like Jack Kemp than it sounded like class warfare.
Jack Kemp, of course. A Republican member of the House of Representatives for many years ago, a Republican who advocated tax cutting, enterprise zones, all sorts of schemes to increase employment and improve the economy.
There weren't tax cuts in here, however. There were more programs than tax cuts, even if they were small programs.
Although we do have opportunity zones.
Tax reform was
proposed. We have opportunity zones to go for.
All right. Well, we could go on for a long time, but alas, our time is up. We've heard the president's fifth official State of the Union address, and this has been coverage from NPR News. You've just heard Ron Elving of NPR, Ramesh Panaru of National Review, and E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to live special coverage from NPR News.
Support for NPR's coverage of the State of the Union comes from Netflix, with Season 2 of House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, and Kate Mara. All episodes premiere on Friday, February 14th, on Netflix.
I'm Poppy Tooker, host of Louisiana Eats. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 4 p.m. for your weekly serving on KRVS 88.7 FM, listener-supported public radio for Acadiana.
Everyone here at KRVS urges our listeners to exercise caution when traveling through icy winter weather conditions and to avoid any unnecessary travel, if at all possible. For more information on emergency alerts and road closures, visit the Louisiana State Police website at lsp.org. This is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette.
This is listener-supported public radio for Acadiana, KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Like us on